You know that feeling when you were a kid and the world was just, I don't know, absolutely drenched in magic?
Oh, yeah, completely.
Like you'd look up at the moon from the backseat of your parents' car and it genuinely felt like it was following you home.
Oh, right.
Or you'd look into the woods behind your house and it wasn't just trees, it was like this infinite, mysterious frontier.
And then, well, you grow up.
Yeah, exactly.
You learn about orbital mechanics, you learn about property lines and county zoning and photosynthesis.
Right. The facts just come rushing in, and suddenly that profound sense of magic, it kind of just evaporates.
You trade your wonder for certainty.
Exactly. You trade wonder for certainty. It's a deeply relatable paradox for a lot of people. The more facts you gather, the more you figure out how the mechanics of the world work, well, the less magical it all feels.
It's a really common modern experience, yeah.
And that tension is exactly why you and I are here today. So for you listening, today we are doing a deep dive into a really unique set of sources.
It's a fascinating collection.
It really is. It's a curated library of philosophical essays, audio recordings, and spiritual reflections by Ninex Antoliou, and it's called Solitude Reflections.
It's an incredibly ambitious collection, honestly.
How so?
Well, if we are looking at the fundamental mission of this material, it serves as a sanctuary of thought, really. It's designed to examine that exact friction between what we know definitively and what must remain a mystery.
The friction between the facts and the magic.
Precisely. And Toliao is attempting to bridge this vast, often unspoken gap between our ancient religious imagination and, well, the complex depths of the modern subconscious mind.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really understand how this library approaches the divine, we first have to look at how our modern obsession with, understanding everything actually damages our capacity for awe.
It does a lot of damage, actually.
Yeah. And Toliao explores this in a reflection titled Mystery Shrinks When Knowledge Steps In, which essentially argues that our drive to comprehend can replace what once felt sacred and untouchable.
And that concept of the untouchable is just critical to human psychology.
Right.
Because when something is untouchable, you stand before it in reverence, you allow it to be larger than yourself.
It has weight.
Exactly. But when you understand it completely, like when you can quantify it and categorize it, you contain it.
You put it in a box.
Yeah, you essentially put the universe in a box that fits perfectly inside your own intellect.
That makes me think of like a physical analogy, like watching an illusionist.
Oh, that's a good comparison.
Right. If you go to a show and watch a magician make a car disappear, your mind is just blown. You are experiencing pure awe.
Because you don't know how it works.
Exactly. But if you sneak backstage and you see the trap doors, the mirrors, the hidden compartments, the wonder vanishes.
The magic is gone.
Yeah, you have the knowledge. Sure, you know how it operates.
Yeah.
But the magic is dead.
Yeah.
So is the argument here that gaining factual spiritual knowledge is like learning the mechanics of a magic trick?
I mean, it is a really profound parallel. And Toliao addresses the consequences of this modern mindset in an essay titled The Lost Language of Metaphor.
The lost language of metaphor.
Right. The core argument is that when we try to understand the sacred purely through the lens of literal, factual, scientific knowledge.
When we just want to hunt for the trapdoors and the mirrors.
Exactly. When we do that, we end up spiritually misreading our own texts and traditions. We lose the metaphor.
But I have to push back on this a little bit.
Sure, go ahead.
Because if you're listening to this right now, you might be thinking, isn't knowledge supposed to bring clarity?
That is the assumption, yes.
Like, if we abandon facts and just live in a world of metaphors and symbols, aren't we essentially just guessing at the truth? Why is losing the metaphor such a tragedy if what we're gaining is actual concrete clarity?
That pushback is entirely understandable because, modern society trains us to believe that literal knowledge and universal truth are the exact same thing.
Right. Fact equals truth.
But in a spiritual context, they aren't. A metaphor isn't a lie or a guess.
What is it then?
It's a vehicle. It's a vehicle required to describe something that is inherently too vast for literal human language.
Oh, I see.
So when you lose the metaphor and demand literal facts, you inevitably start taking profound, infinite spiritual concepts absolutely literally.
Oh, wow. So we read ancient poetry as if it were like a high school biology textbook.
Precisely. And the danger there is that when we literalize the divine, we start projecting our own human flaws, our limits, our emotions onto it.
Which basically shrinks God down to our size.
Yes. The library explores this extensively in pieces like The God We Created and The Deity.
Because we misread the metaphors.
Exactly. Because we misread them, we essentially craft a god in our own image. We create a deity who gets angry, who holds grudges, who plays favorite.
But demands transactional sacrifices.
Yes, exactly.
We basically create a cosmic middle manager.
Cosmic middle manager with a very volatile temper. Yeah.
Right.
And the mechanism of why this fails us is so important to understand.
How so?
Well, when you build a literal human-like god, that framework completely shatters the moment it encounters the reality of human suffering.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
If God is just a big guy in the sky pulling levers, then a natural disaster or a personal tragedy makes that God look either totally incompetent or incredibly cruel.
Because he could have pulled a different lever.
Right. We build a false image based on literalism. And when it inevitably fails to explain our pain, we experience a crisis of faith.
We were worshiping the trapdoor, not the magic.
That is exactly it. We were worshiping the trapdoor.
Okay, so if looking outward to this literal middle manager God is failing us so badly, what is the alternative?
Right.
Because Antolihao doesn't just diagnose this failure, right?
No, not at all.
The library pivots to a really compelling solution. If the external structures are crumbling, Solitude Reflections suggest this radical pivot inward.
Yes, an entirely different direction.
Antolihao frames this in an essay about the kingdom within, which fundamentally redefines where our spiritual authority comes from.
It completely shifts the locus of control.
Right, because historically,
for most of human history, yeah, spiritual authority was entirely external. It was handed down by institutions, by hierarchical figures, by literal readings of ancient texts.
It was a set of rules you just obeyed.
Exactly. But the concept of the kingdom within suggests that true spiritual authority isn't something you absorb from the outside.
It's something you have to actively cultivate internally.
Yes, internally.
Which honestly sounds incredibly liberating. But also kind of terrifying.
It is terrifying. It's a huge responsibility.
Yeah, because if the authority is inside me, I can't just follow a checklist to be a good person anymore. I have to actually listen to my own internal compass.
And that leads directly into how the library repositions the concept of prayer.
Oh, in the essay, The Inner Listener, right?
Yes. If God isn't a cosmic middle manager, then prayer is no longer a list of requests you send into the void, hoping for a favorable response.
It's not a spiritual vending machine.
No, not at all.
You don't put a coin of prayer in and get a blessing out.
The mechanism is entirely different. Prayer and awareness become the very tools for actively shaping your own identity.
Wait, how does that work in practice, though?
Think about it like this. When you stop treating prayer as a request line and start simply observing your own thoughts and desires in silence.
Okay, yeah.
That observation creates a gap. There becomes a space between you and your immediate impulses.
Like taking a step back from yourself.
Exactly. And in that gap, you actively choose who you want to be. You become the inner listener, discovering spiritual freedom by understanding the landscape of your own inner life.
Well, hold on. If the kingdom is within us and finding this inner authority through observation is the ultimate goal.
Right.
What exactly do we encounter when we turn our gaze inward and really look?
Well, it's not always pretty.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because I don't know about you, but when I close my eyes and sit in silence, I don't immediately find a serene, glowing kingdom of peace.
You find the basement full of old boxes.
Yes, exactly that. I hit the messy, chaotic, deeply flawed reality of my own mind.
The anxieties, the weird, humiliating memories from third grade.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah.
The petty grievances, the bad habits.
And to be fair, the library doesn't shy away from this at all.
It really doesn't. Antolihao addresses this head-on in an essay titled The Subconscious Mind.
Right. Looking inward means confronting all of that ingrained psychological wiring.
So my question is, in this framework,
yeah,
is spiritual awakening just a psychological process of rewiring our bad habits?
That's a really common question.
Because if we are just talking about cleaning up our mental basement, how does this differ from just going to a really good therapist?
It is a crucial distinction to make. Therapy, generally speaking, is often about achieving functionality.
Like fixing what's broken.
Right. It's about taking the broken parts of our psychological machinery, analyzing them, and repairing them so we can operate effectively and peacefully in the world.
Okay, that makes sense.
But what Antolihao is talking about goes far beyond psychological repair. We have to look at the process described in The Alchemy of the Soul.
Okay, let's pause on that word, alchemy.
Right, alchemy. In medieval times, physical alchemy was the attempt to turn base metals like lead into gold.
Right, turning something common into something incredibly valuable.
Exactly. So spiritual alchemy is taking the raw, sometimes really messy base material of our human desires, our subconscious habits, our memories.
The lead of our psyche.
The lead of our psyche, and transforming it into something divine.
Wait, so you aren't trying to just get rid of your human desires? Or, like, suppress them until you are a blank slate?
No, not at all.
You're what? Melting them down?
You are refining them. Let's look at a concrete example of how this works.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
Take a raw human trait like ambition.
Okay, ambition.
In its unrefined subconscious state, the lead state ambition might manifest as a selfish, ruthless drive to conquer others and hoard resources.
Yeah, very corporate ladder vibes.
Right. Now, therapy might help you manage that drive so you don't alienate your coworkers or burn yourself out.
Sure.
But spiritual alchemy takes the intense, fiery energy of that ambition and transforms it.
Oh, wow.
You don't kill the drive. You elevate its target.
So it becomes, what, a fierce, selfless ambition to elevate everyone around you?
Exactly. To fight for justice or to create something beautiful.
So you're not just changing how you act. You're changing the fundamental nature of who you are.
Yes.
You are bricking that messy subconscious mind with a higher religious imagination to forge an entirely new self.
Yes, that is beautifully put. It is taking the exact same raw material of your humanity and elevating its nature. That is the alchemy.
But okay, this alchemy feels impossible when I'm, you know, stuck in traffic.
Oh, for sure.
Or dealing with a difficult boss or just trying to survive a really stressful Tuesday.
Real life gets in the way.
Right. We don't live in a serene monastery on top of a mountain. We live in a world defined by conflict and friction.
We do.
So how does this internal kingdom survive the friction of the real world?
Well, it doesn't just survive the friction. It requires it.
It requires it.
Yes. And this brings us to a foundational theme in the library. The nature of human existence itself, specifically the reality of living in a divided world.
Oh, the concept of duality.
Exactly.
And Elio explores this in pieces like From Oneness to Duality and the Power of Duality. Duality being the experience of, like, me versus you, light versus dark, good versus evil.
The experience of separation.
Yeah. And as I was reading this, I kept thinking about physical training.
Okay, how so?
Think about building muscle. If you want to grow a muscle, you cannot do it in zero gravity.
No, you need resistance.
You need the resistance of gravity. You need to pick up something heavy, and you actually have to create micro tears in the muscle tissue.
Right, the stress is the point.
The tension and the stress are what literally cause the growth.
The resistance is the requirement.
Yes. And the argument here is that the soul operates the exact same way.
It really does.
It requires the tension and contrast of duality to achieve spiritual growth.
Mm.
Without the friction of feeling separated from the world, without the daily struggle of contrasting forces, there is no forward momentum.
But this introduces a really fascinating paradox.
What's that?
Because if our highest spiritual goal is to return to this profound sense of unity, this peaceful oneness we talked about,
right?
How do we reconcile that deep, aching longing for unity with the incredibly messy, painful reality of our dual, conflicted nature?
Oh, wow. It feels completely contradictory.
It does.
We desperately want peace, but we structurally need friction to grow.
And Tolliho addresses this beautifully in the reflection, The Good and Evil Within Us.
Okay.
The genius of this library is that it frames moral conflict not as a failure of the human condition, but as the very engine of our freedom.
But wait, I need you to break that down. How is moral conflict the engine of freedom?
Yeah.
Think about it this way. If you're simply a perfect being, operating in a state of absolute, unbroken oneness, you wouldn't actually have any choices.
Because there's no contrast.
Right. You would just be. There would be no alternatives to consider.
Oh, I see.
But because we exist in duality, because we actively feel the pull of both good and evil within our own subconscious minds, we are forced to choose.
We are forced to exercise that inner authority we talked about earlier.
Exactly.
So the struggle itself creates the space for free will.
Yes. That moral conflict, that internal tug of war, is the only environment where true spiritual freedom can exist.
Wow.
Your struggle with your own flaws isn't a sign that you are broken or failing. It is the active laboratory where your spiritual alchemy is taking place.
That completely reframes how you look at a bad day.
It really does.
Or a bad year, for that matter. It gives meaning to the exhaustion of just being a person.
It validates the struggle.
But, you know, taking a step back here, this is a massive, intense journey the library takes us on.
It's a huge arc.
We started by mourning the loss of mystery when factual knowledge steps in and strips away our metaphors.
And we saw how losing that metaphor leads us to project our own flaws into the divine.
Right, creating a small, literal God that just fails us when we suffer.
Exactly.
And to escape that, we turn inward. We try to cultivate our own inner authority as the inner listener.
Which forces us to confront the messy reality of our own subconscious.
The basement of old boxes.
The basement of old boxes, yeah. And rather than just fixing ourselves psychologically, we engage in the alchemy of the soul.
Using the inevitable friction and moral conflict of the real world as the raw fuel for our transformation.
Right. It all connects back together.
It is an incredibly active, almost exhausting internal process. So how do we possibly integrate a shift this massive? We need space to process all of this.
And that brings us right back to the title of the library itself, Solitude Reflections.
Solitude.
Yeah, the integration doesn't happen through more striving, more analysis, or gathering more facts. It happens in the quiet.
In the stillness.
And Tollihau highlights this in the final pieces of the puzzle, Moments of Solitude, and an incredibly profound essay titled Between Nothing and Space.
Which focuses on the concept of emptiness, right?
Emptiness as a profound tool. And Tollihau makes it clear that the only way to genuinely apply these insights is to embrace emptiness.
Which is so hard today.
It's nearly impossible for some. We spend our lives trying to fill every single quiet moment with input, with podcasts, with knowledge, with endless distraction.
Right, checking our phones at stoplights.
Yes. But true action that is born out of genuine inner authority and spiritual alchemy can only emerge from stillness.
You have to create the space between the notes for the music to actually happen.
That's a great way to put it. Inner renewal requires you to stop analyzing the trapdoors of the universe and just sit in the silent space.
You know, we spend so much of our energy trying to decode the external mysteries of the world.
Constantly.
We look up at the moon and try to calculate its exact distance. We try to gather enough facts to make the universe make sense, hoping it will finally give us some peace.
But it never does.
No. But if true spiritual alchemy requires the friction of our divided world, what if our modern push to eliminate all discomfort through endless technology, convenience, and constant entertainment isn't just making us lazy?
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
What if it is actively starving our souls of the very resistance they need to grow? What if the ultimate mystery you need to engage with isn't out there in the stars at all, but is sitting right now in the silence of your own mind, waiting for you to stop distracting yourself long enough to relearn its metaphor?